It is simply great to have all of you here this evening. And what a 2009-2010 Writers on a New England Stage series this is, huh? I mean, are we having fun yet? All right, now, tonight we welcome the acclaimed New York Times bestselling author, Barbara Kingsolver. Miss Kingsolver is here to discuss her latest work, The Lacuna, a rich saga, exotic and engaging, says People magazine. Time rightly calls Kingsolver a magician with words. Now, The Lacuna is the story of a man's search for safety in the jaws, grinding jaws of two nations. With the U.S.-born Harrison Shepard, we cross two decades in Mexico and the United States, moving against the background of vibrant revolutionary murals of Mexico City to the halls of the U.S. Congress. The book brings to life remarkable characters at a remarkable point of in time, including the famous Mexican muralist Diego Rivera and his wife Frida Kahlo and the Bolshevik leader Lev Trotsky. Kingsolver was a scientist before she was a novelist, and it shows in her research. The book comes alive with the colors, sounds, and smells of Mexico, and then the cold northern capital of Washington, D.C. I'm reading it now. I'm loving the characters, and I just find it fascinating, and I really think you will too. Barbara Kingsolver is the author of seven works of fiction, including the beloved novel, The Poisonwood Bible. You bet, one of my very favorites, as well as poetry, essays, and creative nonfiction. She most recently authored the longtime bestseller, Animal Vegetable Miracle, A Year of Food Life. In 2000, Kingsolver was awarded the National Humanity Medal, our country's highest honor for service to the arts. Kingsolver has been quoted as saying, "The meaning of life is contained in the Girl Scout axiom of leaving the campsite better than when you found it." And don't you love that? Those of us who work on Writers on a New England Stage series are committed to bringing you the best, the most thought-provoking new literature and celebrating the life of the mind. And we have some new news on the series. First, we've added a second evening with Greg Mortensen, the author of Three Cups of Tea, at 5 p.m. on Friday, December 4th. Tickets are now on sale to Music Hall members, and they'll go on sale to the public. But let me give you a little inside tip. If you're not a member and you want to get into this show, you might want to become a member now, because I don't think they're going to even last till Saturday. Heads up. Also on sale this Saturday, tickets to our just announced May 5th author, Isabel Allende. Yeah. An embarrassment of riches here at the Music Hall. The Writers on a New England Stage series is a partnership between the Music Hall, New Hampshire Public Radio, and it's in collaboration with River Run Bookstore. Thank you. Let's give it up for our partners. Now, throughout the coming hours, we get to know Barbara Kingsolver and her work. Our house band, Dreadnought, will be playing witty selections of Kingsolver-inspired music, which you can read about in your program. And aren't they just great? Love you guys. After Ms. Kingsolver addresses us, she'll be interviewed by Laura Canoy, host of New Hampshire Public Radio's award-winning call-in program, The Exchange. Laura Canoy is a radio veteran who's worked as a newscaster and reporter for National Public Radio, and in 2007 was named New Hampshire Broadcaster of the Year. For the last 14 years, she's been the host of New Hampshire's only statewide call-in talk show, The Exchange. If you have a question that you would like Laura Canoy to ask Barbara Kingsolver, please jot it on the index cards that we handed out when you came in and pass it to an usher. We're going to answer just as many as we have time for. Now, I'd like to acknowledge our series sponsors, Ogier Building Company. Calypso Communications, New England Audio Tech, Piscataqua Landscaping Company, RMC Research Corporation, Haunted Milk Design, Popovers and Galley Hatch Hospitality Group. Please, let's give them a hand. Thank you. I also want to take this moment to thank the members of the Music Hall and the members of New Hampshire Public Radio, because you make programs like this possible. Here you go, guys. Writers on a New England Stage with Barbara Kingsolver will air on The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio on Friday, November 3rd. And now, about getting Barbara Kingsolver's signed copy of Barbara Kingsolver's book. Backstage, Ms. Kingsolver signed copies of The Lacuna for those in the audience who bought book vouchers in advance through the Music Hall and River Run Bookstore. Lucky you, you've gotten that book at a 10% discount, which is a gift back from the Music Hall and River Run. If you have a voucher and have not yet picked up your book, you can do it in the upper lobby. But if you want to buy a signed copy of the book tonight and have no voucher, please go downstairs to the box office window. So, okay, here it is again. You got your voucher. You stay upstairs. You don't have your voucher. You want to get the book. You go downstairs, okay? We're all good, all right? And remember, a signed copy is a great addition to any reader's library. Christmas is coming up, and so it's a wonderful gift. And please, in the spirit of shop local and our great, vibrant community, buy your books for Writers on a New England Stage here at the Music Hall or at River Run Bookstore. Thank you. And a note for you regulars on Writers on a New England Stage, discount book vouchers are now available for all the upcoming authors. But now, here we are, a remarkable moment on our stage. I'm welcoming the amazing Barbara Kingsolver.
Hello, New England. Looks like you're all here. This is so great. I am quite delighted to be on the New England stage. I always wondered where it was. Now I know. And it's also a special thrill to be here with you on voting day. You all voted, of course. Of course you did. I know about you Yankees. This is really I think of New England as the beating heart of American democracy, the kind of democracy that people really take charge of, including a willingness to sort of throw things out if they don't work and try something new. That's a really important. See, I know about you. I know that this very region has kind of left the United States a couple of times in history, because the U.S. wasn't quite good enough for you. I know about this, and I respect it. And as a matter of fact, we'll get back to that subject later, because that kind of living democracy is something that really. And I thought a lot about when I was writing this book. It really led me to write this novel, which brings me to the second sort of special thrill about this day. For me, anyhow, this is publication day. This is happy birthday to a brand spanking new novel. And it's been a long. I've been working on this book for years. It's a big book. It took years, and that always feels kind of like a pregnancy. You know, you're carrying this around, and it's getting heavier and heavier. And so here it is, the bouncing 7.5 pound. baby book. And I'll just tell you a little story, because this is how you you keep your sanity on book tours. You try to notice something wonderful every day. And this morning, I started this morning in North Carolina, and in the Charlotte airport, about 11 o'clock this morning, I knew this is the day. You know, all these boxes have been shipped out, and they have big orange stickers on them that say "Do not open" until November 2nd. So when I walked by the little, you know, airport bookstore, there was the front shelf that said, "Here are the really important books that you should read." And I try not to pay any attention, but I kind of glanced over and I was kind of looking for the big yellow book. And I thought, well, you know, it's not that important yet. And sort of just walked on by. And then something caught my eye. There were these two young women at the cashier, with boxes, ripping them open, pile them on the counter. It was the lacuna coming out of the box. I'm thinking, get the video camera. This is birth. A cesarean, as a matter of fact. They had box cutters. And a multiple birth indeed. They were piling, you know, about 30 of these on the counter. So that was exciting, I have to admit. I saw it being born. And here I am to celebrate with you. And I will read you a little bit. I'm going to read you just about, probably about 15 minutes, and then we'll talk about the book, and talk about whatever you want to talk about. But I hinted before that this was the notion of democracy and living democracies and people participating in with their governments and sort of forming their governments is what led me into the writing of this book. Now, you're good at that here in New England, as I mentioned, but there are parts of this nation, or there is a kind of thinking in this nation that in my time, what I consider, you know, my lifetime in this country, would identify patriotism with the idea that America is a finished product, not a work in progress. It's just right how it is. And if you criticize it in any way, or if you want to change anything about it, that's un-American. Does this ring a bell? Okay. No, I've heard that a lot. You're likely to be called un-American if you criticize your government, if you criticize the way things are done in your country, even though the people who devised this nation were such rabble-rousers. I think probably they drove their mothers crazy. They were probably the kinds of people who took apart the clocks, you know, completely to see how they ticked and then put them back together, and they grew up to be Thomas Jefferson. They were people who wrote in the Constitution that in order to form a more perfect union, when in the course of human events stuff isn't working, that's what they said, more or less, you change it. So where did this idea of un-Americanism come from? I'm fascinated with that. I always wonder, do people get called un-French or un-Mexican if they criticize their government, or if they want to change? See, to me, that seems like the best kind of patriotism, to want to improve your country. But I've been very curious for a long time about this notion of un-Americanism and where it came from. And I have always known that there was a time in the middle of the last century when the Congress had a committee that was devoted to investigating un-American activities and brought people before this committee basically to just tear them apart, to destroy their lives. And they could be called up for anything, including any sort of disagreement with the status quo, including wanting to change segregation laws, anything that was a little bit out of the mainstream kind of thinking could get you called un-American and get you in big trouble. So I decided to go looking into that history because I was very curious how that came about and what kind of stamp it might have put on our modern psyche. And I had a hunch there might be a novel there. And boy, did I find one. It was a wonderful process for me. I learned a lot. And the novel is very surprising. It has a lot of plot twists and turns. And one of the problems with reading to you from this novel is I don't want to give any of it away. It's almost, in some ways, constructed like a mystery. There are a lot of discoveries that will completely turn around your impression of what's going on in the book. So I'm going to read you just a little from the very beginning. And naturally, a book about Americanism begins in Mexico. For reasons that will all be clear to you after you read the book. Actually, about 30% of the way in, you'll get it. You'll know why you're there. Perhaps even sooner. But I want to read to you a little bit to give you a flavor of not really plot or construction or the meaning of the book, but just the language. One more thing I'll tell you, since this is the annotated lacuna that you get to hear. I'm going to read you the very beginning of the book. I like to do that because the opening page of a book is extremely important to me. I usually rewrite it about 100 or more times. And that's not an exaggeration. It has to be perfect. I believe that the first sentence of a story or the first paragraph of a novel should make a promise to the reader that the rest of the novel will keep. So I'm going to read you the promise. This begins in Isla Pixol, Mexico, 1929. In the beginning were the howlers. They always commenced their bellowing in the first hour of dawn, just as the hem of the sky began to whiten. It would start with just one, his forced rhythmic groaning like a saw blade. That aroused others near him, nudging them to bawl along with his monstrous tune. Soon the maroon-throated howls would echo back from other trees farther down the beach until the whole jungle filled with roaring trees. As it was in the beginning, so it is every morning of the world. The boy and his mother believed it was saucer-eyed devils screaming in those trees, fighting over the territorial right to consume human flesh. The first year after moving to Mexico to stay at Enrique's house, they woke up terrified at every day's dawn to the howling. Sometimes she ran down the tiled hallway to her son's bedroom, appearing in the doorway with her hair loose, her feet like iced fish in the bed, pulling the crocheted bedspread tight as a web around the two of them, listening. It should have been like a storybook here. That is what she'd promised him back in the cold little bedroom in Virginia, North America. If they ran away to Mexico with Enrique, she could be the bride of a wealthy man, and her son would be the young squire in a hacienda surrounded by pineapple fields. The island would be encircled with a shiny band of sea like a wedding ring, and somewhere on the mainland was its gem, the oil fields where Enrique made his fortune. But the storybook was the prisoner of Zenda. He was not a young squire, and his mother, after many months, was still no bride. Enrique was their captor, surveying their terror with a cool eye while eating his breakfast. "That howling is the aullaros," he would say, slicing into his eggs with a fork and knife. "They howl at one another to settle out their territories before they begin a day of hunting for food. Their food might be us, Mother and son agreed. When they huddled together inside the spiderweb of bedspread, listening to a rising tide of toothsome roars. "You had better write all this in your notebook," she said, "the story of what happened to us in Mexico. So when nothing is left of us but bones, someone will know where we went." She said to start this way. In the beginning were the aullados, crying for our blood. Enrique had lived his whole life in that hacienda, ever since his father built it and flogged the Indios into planting his pineapple fields. He had been raised to understand the usefulness of fear. So it was nearly a year before he told them the truth. The howling is only monkeys. He didn't even look across the table when he said it, only at the important eggs on his plate. He hid a scornful smile under his mustache, which is not a good hiding place. "Every ignorant Indian in the village knows what they are. You would, too, if you went out in the morning instead of hiding in bed like a pair of sloths." It was true. The creatures were long-tailed monkeys eating leaves. How could such a howling come from a thing so honestly ordinary? But it did. The boy crept outdoors early and learned to spot them high in the veil of branches against white sky. Hunched woolly bodies balanced on swaying limbs, their tails reaching out to stroke the branches like guitar strings. Sometimes the mother monkeys cradled little babes born to precarious altitudes, clinging for their lives. So there weren't any tree demons. And Enrique was not really a wicked king. He was only a man. He looked like the tiny man on top of a wedding cake, the same round head with parted, shiny hair, the same small mustache. But the boy's mother was not the tiny bride. And of course, there is no place on that cake for a child. When Enrique wanted to ridicule him after that, he didn't even need to mention devils. He only rolled his eyes up at the trees. "The devil here is a boy with too much imagination," he usually said. That was like a mathematics problem. It gave the boy a headache because he couldn't work out which was the wrong part of the equation, being a boy or being imaginative. Enrique felt a successful man needed no imagination at all. Okay, that was the promise, and I'll give you a hint. Novels are symbolic. It's not really about monkeys, but you knew that. Okay, shall I go on? Shall I read another passage? Yes, okay. This is just a few pages later. Here you get to know the boy and his mother, Salome. You get to know a little bit about their relationship. On Saturday night before Holy Week, Salome wanted to go into town to hear the music. Her son would have to go too, as she needed an elbow to hang upon while walking around the square. She preferred to call him by his middle name, William, or just Will, conditioned as that is on future events, "you will." Though on her tongue, of course, it sounded like wheel, a thing that serves, but only when in motion. Salome Huerta was her name. She had run away at a young age to become an American Sally, and then Sally Shepherd for a while, but nothing ever lasted long. American Sally was finished. This was the year of Salome pouting, her last one in the hacienda on Isla Pichol, though no one knew it yet. That day, she had pouted because Enrique had no intention of walking around with her on the Zocalo just to show off a frock. He had too much work to do. Work meant sitting in his library, running both hands through his slick hair, drinking mezcal, and sweating through his collar while working out colonnades of numbers. By this means, he learned whether he had money up to his mustache this week or only up to his bollocks. Salome put on the new frock, painted a bow on her mouth, took her son by the arm, and walked to town. They smelled the socalo first, roasted vanilla beans, coconut milk candies, boiled coffee. The square was packed with couples walking entwined, their arms snaking around one another like the vines that strangle tree trunks. The girls wore striped wool skirts, lace blouses, and their narrow-waisted boyfriends. The mood of the fiesta was enclosed in a perfect square, four long lines of electric bulbs strung from posts at the corners, fencing out a bright piece of night just above everyone's heads. The musicians stood in the little round belvedere whose pointed roof and wrought iron railings were all freshly painted white, along with everything else, including the giant old fig trees around the square. Their trunks blazed in the darkness, but only out to a certain point, as if a recent flood of whitewash through town had left a high water mark. Salome seemed happy to float with the moving river of people around the square, even though in her elegant lizard skin shoes and flapper crepe that showed her legs, she looked like no other person there. The crowd parted for her. Probably it pleased her to be the green-eyed Spaniard among the Indians, or rather the criolla, Mexican-born but pure nonetheless, with no Indian blood mixed in. Her blue-eyed half-American son was less pleased with his position, a tall weed growing among the broad-faced townspeople. They would have made a good illustration for a book showing the castes of the nation, as the school books did in those days. "Next year," said Salome in English, pinching his elbow with her fierce crab claws of love, "you'll be here with your own girl. This is the last Noche Palmas you'll want to walk around here with your old wrinkle." She liked using American slang, especially in crowds. "This is posalutely the berries," she would announce, putting the two of them inside an invisible room with her words and closing the door. "I won't have a girlfriend." "You'll turn 14 next year. You're already taller than President Portes Gil. Why wouldn't you have a girlfriend?" "Portes Gil isn't even a real president. He only got in because Obregón was iced." "And maybe you will likewise ascend to power after some girl's first novio gets the sack? Doesn't matter how you get the job, ducky. She'll still be yours." "Mother, next year you could have this whole town if you want it." "But you'll have the girl. This is all I'm saying. You'll go off and leave me alone." It was a game she played, very hard to win. "Or if you don't like it here, Mother, you could go somewhere else. Some smart city where people have better entertainments than walking in circles around the Zocalo." "And," she persisted, "you'd still have the girl." "Not just a girl, but the girl, already an enemy." "What do you care? You have Enrique." "You make him sound like a case of the pox." In front of the wrought iron bandstand, the crowd had cleared a space for dancing. Old men in sandals held stiff arms around their barrel-shaped wives. "Mother, next year, no matter what, you won't be old." She rested her head against his shoulder as they walked. He had won. Salome hated that her son was now taller than she was. The first time she noticed, she was furious. Then morose. In her formula of life, this meant she was two-thirds dead. The first part of life is childhood. The second is your child's childhood. And then the third, old age. Another mathematics problem with no practical solution, especially for the child. Growing backward, becoming unborn. That would have been just the thing. They stopped to watch the mariachis on the platform, handsome men with puckered lips giving long kisses to their brass horns. Trails of silver buttons led down the sides of their tight black trousers. The Zocalo was jammed now. Men and women kept arriving from the pineapple fields with the day's dust still on their feet, shuffling out of the darkness into the square of electric light. The married couples began to surrender dancing space to a younger group, girls with red yarn braided into their hair and wound around their heads into thick crowns. Their white dresses swirled like froth, with skirts so wide they could take the hems in their fingertips and raise them up to make sudden wings like butterflies fluttering as they turned. The men's high-heeled boots cut hard at the ground, drumming like penned stallions. When the music paused, they leaned across their partners in the manner of animals preparing to mate. Move away, come back. The girls waggled their shoulders. The men put handkerchiefs under their arms and then waved them beneath the girls' chins. Salome decided she wanted to go home immediately. We would have to walk, Mother. Natividad won't come for us until 11, because that's what you told him. Then we'll walk, she said. Just wait another half hour. Otherwise, we'll be walking in the dark. Bandits might murder us. Nobody will murder us. The bandits are all in the Zocalo trying to steal purses. Salome was practical, even as a hysteric. You hate to walk. What I hate is watching these primitives showing off. A she-goat in a dress is still a she-goat. Darkness fell down on everything then, like a curtain. Someone must have shut off the lights. The crowd breathed out. The butterfly girls had set glasses with lighted candles onto their braid-crowned heads. As they danced, their candles floated across an invisible surface like reflections of the moon across a lake. Salome was so determined to walk home, she had already started in the wrong direction. It wasn't easy to overtake her. Indian girls, she spat. What kind of man would chase after that? A corn eater will never be any more than she is. The dancers were butterflies. From 100 paces, Salome could see the dirt under these girls' fingernails, but not their wings. All right, I'm going to read you one last passage that's very short. Just because I want to give you, I will move you a little bit forward in the book, not very far. We're still in Mexico, but as you know, this, as you could probably tell, this Salome is not going to stay anywhere very long. They within 2 years, have moved to Mexico City. Harrison Shepard, her son, who's the narrator of this book, he's the character you will follow all the way through until the 1950s. In the United States, for various reasons I won't explain. He can't go to regular school in Mexico City. So, she puts him into what they call a school for cretins and boys of bad character, which really existed. They were run by nuns, and so. He doesn't like it very much, and so he doesn't go. And instead, he gets his education on the streets, and he hangs around in the marketplaces, and you just see a lot of life in 1930s Mexico City. And this is an occasion in one of the outdoor markets when the narrator sees for the first time a person who will become extremely important in the rest of his life and in the rest of the novel. She is a real person. She is, in fact, an historical figure who plays an important role in this novel. I won't identify her. I'll see if you can perhaps guess who she is. 29 September. Today, and I should also say that this is written as, most of the novel is presented as journal entries, his journal. 29 September. Today at the Melchor Market, a fantastical sight. A servant girl with a birdcage on her back, full of birds. She wore her blue shawl wrapped around the cage and tied in front to hold it. The willow cage must have been very light because she was not bent over, yet it towered over her head with turrets like a Japanese pagoda. And full of birds, green and yellow, flapping about like dreams trying to escape from a skull. She looked like an angel moving down the rows, following her mistress, looking at no one. The mistress had stopped to haggle with a man and buy another bird. She was so tiny, from the back she also looked like a servant girl. But when she turned, her skirts and silver earrings whirled, and her face was very startling. An Azteca queen with ferocious black eyes. Her hair was braided in a heavy crown, like the Isla Pichol girls, and her posture very regal, though she wore the same ruffled skirts as her maid. She gave the vendor his money and took two green parrots, slipping them neatly into the cage on the girl's back, then moved off quickly toward the street. The old market woman, La Perla, said, "Don't fall in love with that one, guapo. She's taken, and her man carries a gun." "Which one is married, the servant girl or the queen?" La Perla laughed, and so did her friend, old Cienfuegos. "That's no queen there," she said. "More like a puta," was La Perla's opinion. But old Cienfuegos did not agree. "It's her husband who chases women, not the other way around." The two of them argued about whether the tiny Azteca queen was a harlot. But they agreed on one thing. That regal little woman is married to the discutido pintador, the much-discussed painter. Who discusses him so much? Cienfuegos said, "The newspapers." La Perla said, "Everyone, guapo, because he is a communist. Also the ugliest man you ever saw." Cienfuegos asked how she knew what he looked like. Did he come around courting her? La Perla said she saw him once at the Plaza Caballito, down there with the troublemakers when the workers had their strike. He was as fat as a giant and horribly ugly, with the face of a frog and the teeth of a communist. "They say he eats the flesh of young girls wrapped in a tortilla. He's a cannibal. And from the look of her, I would say his little bride there might also eat children for lunch. From the look of things today, they're having parrot stew." "No, guapo," La Perla said, "not to eat. Those birds are for his paintings. He paints pictures of the strangest things. If he gets up in the morning and wants to paint the hat of an Englishman, his wife has to go find him the hat of an Englishman. Small or big, if he wants to paint it, eso. She has to run to the market and buy it." "She must be carrying a lot of money in her purse then," said Cienfuegos, "because the newspaper says right now he's painting the National Palace." I will close my reading here so that we'll have time for conversation after. I thank you so much.
Well, it's great to be back here on Writers on a New England Stage, and especially with you, Barbara Kingsolver. Let's talk about the title of the book before we get into some of the themes that come up in this book and your many other works. What is, Barbara, a lacuna?
A lacuna is, it's one of those wonderful words that means a lot of different things. It's a hole or a tunnel or a cave. It's a passage that connects one thing with another. It also is a word that people who work with old manuscripts know this word, because it refers to a missing piece of a manuscript, an important missing passage that somehow has disappeared. And it also refers to missing pieces of history. It means a gap, something that has been erased, such as a part of history that we've all forgotten about. It's such a great word. I was actually writing this novel for several years under a provisional title that I didn't like very much. It was just kind of the label you put on the filing cabinet. I won't even tell you what it is because I didn't like it. I knew the right title was coming. And one day this word occurred to me. It must have been in the back of my mind, because this word connects everything in this novel. It's really, this novel is about the missing pieces and literal tunnels and all of these things. It was perfect. I mean, I probably, you know, smacked myself on the forehead and said Eureka or something dumb. And I was thrilled until I went downstairs to tell my husband, oh, you know, yay, I have the right title. And I said this word, and he said, honey, people don't know what that means. And I said, oh, well, they could learn.
Well, and I won't give it away, but it is perfect, and it does tie everything together in the book. And as you said, it means an opening or a hole. With this book, Barbara, what holes in our history are you trying to fill?
I actually kept discovering more and more. There are a lot of lacunae. The plural is, it's a Latin word, so the plural has got an E on the end. There are a lot of lacunae that I sort of opened up in my research. One of the important characters in this book is Lev Trotsky, a historical figure who was extremely important in the Russian Revolution and could have been extremely important to, well, the history of the world and the way it's all organized, and he's been erased from history for very interesting reasons. Also, this whole period of American history when when the United States government fiercely censored artists and dissidents of every kind and put them in jail, just erased people's voices, was something I wanted to look at. I discovered so many more missing pieces. And the novel itself, in fact, is constructed as a manuscript with missing pieces. So the answer is really for the reader himself or herself to discover. There are probably parts of the book that will be more important to some readers than others, but I think all of us have these missing pieces in our own histories. And one of the things that people say in this novel a lot, and I mean in one way or another, is that the most important part of the story is the part you don't know. The most important thing about a person is what you don't know about them. Even someone you know very well could have a missing piece that you don't know about, and that you would alter your judgment if you knew it better.
I'd like to return to this theme that you have talked about, and that is the McCarthy era and your fascination with that era. And about a decade ago, in a New York Times interview about your other really big, big, big book, The Poisonwood Bible, you said that literary critics made a fatal mistake in the 50s by caving to McCarthyism, allowing a gulf to divide art from politics. And this is a theme that comes up in the lacuna as well. So it makes me think that you have been toying with this idea of doing a book about McCarthyism, art, politics, for a long time.
I've been thinking about this question for a long time. I did hope someday I would be able to grapple with it. I always begin a book with a big question that seems so important to me that I could spend years of my life with it, and then turn it over to to you, to readers, and ask you to spend, not years of your life with it, but at least, you know, 3 or 4 days. It needs to be really important enough. It needs to be an engaging question. And this seemed like a really important question to me. I didn't know quite how I would go about it until more recently. But it's a question that I keep running into, why people are so suspicious in this country, or uneasy is probably a better term, uneasy with any combination of art and politics. And I had a hunch it went back to this time when people were really quite fiercely censored. I thought that probably it created a climate of fear that we haven't quite gotten over.
Yeah, you're quite critical of that climate of fear in the book, and you say a lot about it. Do you run into trouble, Barbara, sort of looking back now with 2009 hindsight? You know, we all would say, oh, that was bad. Were there legitimate fears, though, then, of the country really being taken over by people who did not have our best interests at heart?
It's very interesting to look at what led up. Well, that's of course what I did. I investigated what allowed this country to be so seized by fear, because what we think of as the McCarthy era started before McCarthy ever got to the Senate. It really began shortly after World War II. During World War II, Joe Stalin was our best friend, according to Life magazine, who called him Tom Paine and Paul Bunyan rolled into one. He was in that's a quote. I didn't make this stuff up. That's the interesting thing, is that while this is a novel, it is steeped in fact. I didn't invent this. This all really happened. And I didn't, it's interesting that you raise my sort of criticism of it. I really just give it to you as a reader. All I'm doing is saying, look what happened. And I'm the extra thing you can do with a novel that journalism or nonfiction can't do is I can put you there, and I can actually put you in the life, in the sort of heart and mind and soul of a character who has to suffer the consequences. You get to decide whether this was right or wrong, what made it, what were the social circumstances that allowed this culture of fear to come up, where did it come from and why. But as an extra bonus with a novel, you don't just judge it from the outside, you feel it. It gives you an extra sensation of what it was, and that gives you its worth. That really lets you make decisions based on genuine human import.
Do you think that separation of art and politics that you felt really came apart, especially during the McCarthy era, do you think that's changed, Barbara, now in our time, that the two have gotten back together, or do we still make this distinct separation?
We're still really uneasy with it in this country. I know this because I run into it all the time. And you know what's funny? It's just here. It's not, I mean, other countries don't make the separation. Mexico, for example, celebrates its most political artists, such as Diego Rivera, as national heroes. Europe gives Nobel Prizes to their most political artists. Many countries elect their most political poets to public office. It's in the rest of the world. Well, when we say politics, that can mean many things. But just, I think that what we're talking about here is the affairs of humankind that give power to some over others, and the possibilities of addressing those differences in power based on race, based on gender, based on class, or what have you. Sort of rattling the cage of the status quo and sort of asking for more social justice. I think that's what we're talking about here when we say politics. And in every other country where I've ever been, and most countries I've read about, that's absolutely considered the normal domain of art. So I've always wondered, why is it a problem here? That's what really got me thinking, that We must have, it's like PTSD. You know, we must be in some sort of post-traumatic stress that we can't, you know, we can't just get over this. We keep saying, oh, well, that's political. Can that be art? When I go on book tour in Europe, you know, nobody asks me that.
Well, and I want to ask you about your own politics and how they play into your novels. But just on this a little bit more, some people would say rap music is political. Books like The Color Purple are political. Michael Moore's movies are political. Here in New Hampshire, Maxine Kuman's poetry is political. So we do see some of that.
I would also say I think all good art is political. I think that, well, art can be anything it wants to be. It can address important questions, or it can address big questions or small questions. It can tackle whatever it wants, and people can take it or leave it. But good art moves people in some direction. I think anyone would agree with this. A good work of art takes you somewhere in your life that you haven't been before. A novel is particularly good at this because a novel actually puts you inside the life of someone you've never been before. Maybe someone who's a whole different ethnicity from you, who lives in a different country, who's on the other side of some divide. And what it does is builds empathy for the theoretical stranger. That is a political act. A novel brings you into another point of view. It could be a point of view anywhere on the political spectrum. It's interesting that the artists you raise tend to be considered more leftists, but it could move you in a rightward direction also. A novel, regardless of the politics of the novelist, a novel creates empathy for someone you've not been. It shifts you into another point of view. That's political. It's powerful. I think that what novelists at minimum should do as moral people is to own up to that power, to understand that we are wielding something very potent here, and to use it carefully and wisely.
So no art for art's sake, relaxation, rest, enjoyment, kicking back.
of course, as I said, art can be anything at once, and we can take it or leave it. And art, all art, is for human's sake.
Let's talk a little bit more about that then. And we have talked to a lot of writers in this series who have very different views about what the role of the fiction writer is. Some say, I'm just writing novels for the sheer pleasure of writing novels for the enjoyment of my public. Others really feel like they have a role to play in our society. How much do you feel, Barbara, that literature, as opposed to nonfiction or journalism, has a greater capacity to spur people to take action?
Well, I think I think I answered that question, right? It creates empathy. Empathy for a stranger is the most political act in the world. It's the antidote to war.
I want to ask you about a big theme in The Lacuna that you mentioned in your opening remarks as well. Frequent and harsh critiques of the media at that time, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, and you called the howlers and so forth. Harrison Shepard calls journalists howlers, relating to the monkeys. What about today's media, Barbara? Do you think that everybody in the media, from Fox News to NPR to the New York Times to the blogs to the web pages, are they all to some extent howlers today?
Well, I would say that this novel, first of all, I'm going to say again that I didn't make this up. And I was pretty amazed to read, to see so much yellow journalism in the, I read just tons and tons of archives, old newspapers and magazines from the 1930s, 40s, and 50s. And even what we think of as mainstream media referred to Japanese people as Japs. sort of love to run these stories about, I mean, used language that just seems harrowing to me now, but loved passing on these stories about sort of evildoers of all kinds, you know, sort of to generate propaganda during wartime. It was so amazing to me that this was, that the media were this sort of, well, we would say irresponsible, printing scare stories that were not not evidence-based. I thought, if I try to represent this, people think I'm making it up. So I actually used throughout this novel real news stories from the New York Times, from Life magazine. I had to get permission to use them, you know, and pay copyright fees so that I could put these in here. So you're not, so you wouldn't say, oh, she's just making this up. It's real. I interspersed also newspaper articles that I wrote that are made up, that are fictional, because they have to do with the character and what happens to him. But many people who've read it and commented on it said they couldn't tell, they didn't know which was real and which was not. So I just put a handy list in the front on the first page of the novel so you can go back and see which of these articles are real. I would say that this, okay, and then to move from there forward, I kept thinking, nothing has changed, really. When the top story of the week is about a boy that didn't fall out of a balloon because he wasn't in there, and that's really the top story. You know, I'm not making this up. So I would say this book is an indictment of lazy journalism, and it will be interesting to see who's steps forward to be offended.
Well, I have a lot more questions, but I want to share some questions from the audience as well. And again, if you want to hand in your cards, I'll be happy to go to as many of your questions as possible. Here's one question. When you're not on your book tour, are you still trying to live off the land as you described in Animal Vegetable Miracle?
Well, I live on a farm in southwestern Virginia, and we have an enormous garden. It seems to get bigger every year, in spite of my best efforts. Mainly, this book, it wasn't a novel, it's a nonfiction book, was a narrative about local food, and it was kind of a narrative about a year of my family's engaging with our own local food system. We really were never trying, per se, to live off the land. We grow a lot of our own food, but what we wanted to do was try to use as much local food as we could, and we found there was so much more than we expected, and that our own farmers market and our own neighborhood farmers provided much better stuff than we could get from far away. It's just, there are lots of reasons why it's better. Now that I have made friends with my guys at the farmer's market, all of my farmer friends, my guys and my men and women friends at the farmer's market who provide us with so much of what we need, I couldn't possibly turn my back on them. This is their living. I love what they do. It's a way of life for us. It really was never meant to be a year-long stunt or anything like that, you know, which I know you didn't think that. And indeed, it wasn't. It's a way of life for us. And it's a way of life for thousands of people who have discovered that taking control of your own food chain is very liberating, and it's very good for your community, for your environment, for your local economy, and it seems a very natural thing for New Englanders to do.
How was that for you, Barbara, diving into nonfiction like that and chronicling yourself, your own life, kind of putting yourself out there?
I've always really enjoyed moving back and forth between fiction and nonfiction. My very first book actually was a nonfiction book. It was a book about a mine strike in Arizona. I think 75 or 80 people have read it. it's called Holding the Line. I was a Stringer reporter and covering this rather amazing mine strike in which women had to take over their towns and the strike in this very traditional little Mexican-American community. And it became a book. That was in 1983, I guess. So since then, this is my 13th book, and there's no exactly half with 13, is there? Half are nonfiction, half are fiction, and there's one poetry book. So I've always really liked having an option. As I mentioned before, I like beginning with a question, a big question, or a question of some size. And then I think about what's the best vehicle for transporting it. Sometimes fiction is better, and sometimes narrative nonfiction was the best for Animal Vegetable Miracle for a lot of reasons. Sometimes essays or op-ed pieces are the best way to go. I like having choices. In terms of sort of self-revelation, Animal Vegetable Miracle, it's funny, I've said this to I don't know how many journalists, it's not about me. It's not, because, I mean, many journalists wanted to come and see the farm, you know, and we don't do that. It's our home. It's where we live. It's not about the bike, you know. It's not about the farm. It's a narrative about what all of us can do in our lives to engage more with our local economies. And I used sort of pieces of our own story as an illustration. But, you know, of course, if you think about it, in any given year, a million things happen to you and only, you know, 2% of them go into the book. So very important things that happened in our family that were personal, you know, having to do with, you know, deaths in the family and so forth. Didn't, of course, go into the book. So it wasn't, I didn't think of it as a memoir. I didn't set out to write about myself so much as I set out to illustrate a process, a change in thinking by using our story as a vehicle. And it was very much like writing a novel in that I had a landscape of things to write about, and I selected the right details to sort of, and it had to have characters and a narrative arc, a plot and resolution. Who knew when I began? I knew I'd have to find some way of invoking suspense, because you have to give the readers a reason to keep reading. So obviously they knew we were going to survive the year. It wasn't like that. It wasn't like, you know, a reality show. So I had to find it much like, as I said, you know, a novel is symbolic. It's not really about monkeys. And we'll see if anyone steps forward to say, no, I am a monkey. But in this case, I had to find sort of symbolic parts of the story that would give it suspense. And who knew that the real suspense would hang on turkey sex, which it does.
I saw that article. Well, on that point about which vehicle you use to make your point, whether it's an essay, whether it's nonfiction, whether it's a novel, you have acknowledged the need to give people a good story. You're not just your dose of political thought, but your...
I wouldn't dream of just wanting... I never tell people what to do. Not even in my own life. And I think that a good novel is like a walk with that really good kind of friend. You know, you have certain friends you really want to talk to when you have a big problem, because they're not going to tell you what to do. You're going to walk down a trail with them, or, you know, the sidewalk, and you're going to talk about all these big things, and she's there and she's listening and she's saying, well, yeah, and there's this part, and did you think about this part? And then when you're finished, she turns to you and says, what do you think? That's what a novel does. That's what I want to do when I write. It doesn't matter what I think. I would never dream of telling people what to think. That doesn't interest me. If I were that kind of person, I think I would have gone into a different line of work, because I don't think that's a good approach for an artist.
So you're thinking about striking that balance of making your point, but making it in a way that a friend would make, allowing you to come to your own conclusions.
Yeah, exactly. I don't make points. I ask. I ask questions.
I have a couple more questions from our audience, and we often have writers and aspiring writers here who always want to know about the writing process, and I wonder, one of them wants to know how your writing process has changed since moving from Tucson to Appalachia.
Well, my writing process hasn't. The most important thing I can say about my writing process is that I'm a mother. I became an author and a mother on the same day, if you can believe it. my oldest daughter is 22 years old. My youngest is 13. So I've had a small kid in the house for a long time. And the day that my eldest was born, the day at like 16 hours after she was born, I came home from the hospital and the message machine was beeping. Remember those? And it was a call saying that HarperCollins was going to publish my first novel, The Bean Trees. And I was in a hormonal stupor. I had just made this beautiful baby. I was the queen of the world. I thought, oh, that's nice. HarperCollins, good. And eventually it hit me that this was my new profession, that I would be able to make a living. Before that, I'd been a journalist and a scientist and many, many other things, a lab technician, lots of other jobs. But being a writer for a living, being a novelist for a living, was a miracle to me. And yet, I was also the mother of a baby. So for my whole life, I'm no longer the mother of a baby, but sometimes. and vice versa. So my writing process has always been defined by the school bus.
What time it comes?
In the morning, it comes in the evening. Right in between those moments, but when like any other working mother, I've always worked when my kids were in someone else's care, as many people know, working parents, I should say. This means I don't have time to sit around waiting for the muse. You know, my muse carries a baseball bat. I get right down to work. I've never had time for writer's block. I just have to be very efficient. And so I sit down to work, and writing a novel is different from nonfiction in that you go into another world. I mean, people talk to you and you talk back. you say, oh, goodbye, family. I'm going to spend time now with my imaginary people for hours and hours and hours. And then when the day's work ends, I have to snap out of that. You know, I have to just go down to the kitchen and start dinner. So it does, without medication. So it does require a kind of discipline of pulling myself back out of that place where sometimes I would like to stay. But it's probably healthy. It's probably for the best.
Well, about that process of writing, I have read, Barbara, that you love, unlike maybe some other writers, you love the process of editing, rewriting, tearing it up and rewriting it again.
Revision is my favorite thing. I love revision. I think, maybe I'm wrong, but I think most writers much prefer revision to writing a first draft. Writing a first draft feels like hoeing a row of potatoes. You know, you just You just keep going till you get to the end. After that, the fun begins, because then you get to go backwards. You become unstuck in time. You know, you move back and forth through your creation, tying everything together. It's so wonderful to go back and begin again, already knowing the ending, because that, and sometimes the last paragraph becomes the first paragraph. And I do love word processing. I mean, a computer really helps. It's funny that the novel as a form has changed very, very little in, you know, 400 years. It's still basically what it's always been, which you can't say about too many other forms of art. And I think that what we do as novelists hasn't changed a lot, but man, does a computer help. I can't even imagine how Charles Dickens did what he did, you know, writing pieces at it. Maybe we don't need to go into that, but he wrote his greatest novels as serials, which were sent out. I mean, people were waiting on the docks for the next chapter of Great Expectations. He had to finish it and send it out. He could imagine how much better that novel could have been if he'd had a computer. Really? I'm serious. I hope that doesn't sound heretical, but I think if he were sitting here, he would agree with me. I swear to you. So I love being able to move pieces of text around, and I love the delete key. You know, just boink, it's gone. It doesn't have to, you know, it's... I always say that the first... Getting started is also very hard. The first 100 pages should get thrown away, you know. And that used to be really depressing to me, to begin a book by writing pages and pages and pages that I knew had to be thrown away. And they pile, you know, think of all those dead trees. It's so sad. But now I can just delete them. And by the way, I thought of a new way to think of this that makes me feel better. I'm writing pages minus 100 to zero. They have to get written. It's like digging for gold. You know, you have to get rid of the dirt before you get to the gold. So the beginning is rugged. It takes a while just to hit your stride, find the voice. But even once you do, after you find where it's going to go, then you're so informed. It's like you get to be, you're omniscient. You can inform every slant of light, everything in a room, every piece of dialogue, everything that happens can be invested with meaning, with this sort of rich subtext that's leaning into your story, that moves it forward, foreshadowing all of these things. That's the fun part. I would do it forever. I mean, sometimes my publishers have to kind of pry a manuscript out of my fingers, because I could keep, you know, I could do this for, I could just keep making it better. And then give me Great Expectations. No, just kidding, just kidding. No.
Well, and on that, how did the fact that you chose several true characters in this book affect your writing process? Because as I understand, you were quite diligent in making sure that you were very historically accurate when it came to Trotsky and others who you present in this book. So did that slow you down, make it harder, make it easier, or what?
The research in general made this a slow go. You know, I've been working on this since February. I worked on it for 7 years, from February of 2002 to February of this year. A lot of that time was spent in research, reading old archives, going to the places where this book is set in Mexico and in the U.S. And yes, there are some real people who show up in this novel, who don't just walk through. They're real. They're characters. They're important to the story. Frida Kahlo, you guessed right that was who. Yeah, of course you did. Frida Kahlo and Diego Rivera, the man who eats flesh in a tortilla, which actually came from a Mexican newspaper, and Lev Trotsky, and later on, but those are the most important, but there are other figures too who come into play. And because this is, among many other things, a novel about what media attention and sort of public attention does to people, to public people, the whole phenomenon of gossip, news as gossip, gossip as news, and the way that there's something in us, it seems, in the human soul that wants to believe the worst things about public figures. I really wanted to investigate that. I wanted to ask the readers, why do we do this? What's wrong with this picture, if anything? And so naturally, I didn't want to do that to these people. So I was really, really careful about reading everything that was ever written about them and by them, and I was absolutely accurate. If, for example, Frida Kahlo went in, you know, in her real life, went into the hospital on December 12th of 1932, that's where she is in my novel. That I had this grid of historical fact that I had to establish first, and then weave my own plot with my invented narrator, Harrison Shepherd, through that grid. And so it was time consuming. It took a lot of time, a lot of work, and it was really, really fun.
One last question for you, and I have this in several forms from our audience. A lot of people tonight want to know if you are working on a new book, and can you give us a little preview?
This is the question that writers on book tour smile through their teeth when they answer. I would love to be working on a book, but I also love being here with you. So, and you can, working on a novel for me feels like being in love, and so I'm there as much as humanly possible. When a book is published, it is also important to go out into the world, put writing aside for, you know, a few weeks, and meet the people who really make this happen. And that is so important to me. And I'm not kidding. I'm not just being polite. I am really happy to be here, because this is what I think about a novel or a work of art in general. When I finish it, it's half done. When you read it, it's all done. You finish it. Whatever happens in your heart when you take in a work of art is the completion of that act. So thank you for doing that.
Writers on a New England Stage is a collaboration between the Music Hall and New Hampshire Public Radio in collaboration with River Run Bookstore. The executive producer and live stage presentation director is Patricia Lynch. The New Hampshire Public Radio president is Betsy Gardella. NHPR broadcast producer is Keith Shields. The associate producer is Tom Holbrook with River Run Bookstore. The associate producer and director of strategic communications is Margaret Talcott. The live sound engineer is Eric Reuter. Recording and mixing engineer is Mike Marchand. The musical director and band is Bob Lord at Dreadnought. And special thanks again to our special guest tonight, Barbara Kingsolver. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you.